I hope everybody's having a great 4th of July weekend so far. We just had a little conversation before we went on the air here tonight on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett, about what kind of bumper music we were going to use. And being the 4th of July weekend, you know, the kind of the default position for the music bumpers would be something patriotically themed. But because tonight's guest is presents such a unique musical opportunity, that I suggested that, you know, maybe we go vampire music, maybe we go the music of the night, music of the undead, for tonight's conversation about the field guide to vampires. But even as I said that, then it occurred to me that the real challenge for any, you know, any producer worth the reputation that Jesse has developed over the years is to come up with patriotic vampire music. So, you know, that's the bar we've raised. Is it possible to find patriotic vampire music? We'll find out coming up in the bumpers ahead on Coast to Coast AM. And it was nice of George Norrie to say last night that he was going to try and stay up and catch this show. You'd think a guy like George, you know, trying to stay up wouldn't be such a problem. He'd be completely used to that. But, you know, some people, when they have a night off, doesn't matter what it is, they just, you know, they're going to sleep in. Well, is that true for vampires? You know, does a vampire take a night off by sleeping, by going to bed early and just getting up early? Does that constitute what it is for most of us? If we're going to be, you know, trying to have something fun and enjoyable, we stay up later, you know, and just go out and go a little crazy during the night. When vampires let things loose, do they do the same thing except just get up earlier and go out and have some fun in the daytime? Or does none of that matter? There's only one person that could answer all these questions tonight, and we've got him coming up. The Field Guide to Vampires. If you were to look for a field guide to the birds of North America, you would find what are the most popular field guides in publishing. It has maps and different classifications of birds, indices, to let you know where the birds are, what kind of birds you're going to find if you're going to a particular area. Realistic illustrations, colorful, easy to understand guide to American bird species, including seabirds. And if you were going to be doing something for fish, you could do the same thing. You could find a field guide to fish, like Ken Schultz's Field Guide to Saltwater Fish, based on the award-winning reference book, the Fishing Encyclopedia. This is a handy field guide that lets everybody know exactly what kind of saltwater species they might be encountering. The size, the age, the habitat, the life history, you know, lets everybody know easily what's at the end of their fishing line. The Field Guide to Saltwater Fish. Same thing with the National Wildlife Federation Field Guide to Insects and Spiders. I actually even found a field guide to bears. But if you Google field guide to bears, it's not about bears. It's apparently a very popular book and poster explaining the various types of hairy gay men that are out there that are referred to as bears. So that was not the same. Or is it? To the Field Guide to Vampires. This is a fun book, an interesting book, but a book that will tell us exactly how we should be behaving around vampires. What is it that a vampire will likely be do if we encounter one in the wild? What will a vampire be expecting from us? How does a vampire respond when it is caught in the act or of feeding, or whether it's out there patrolling in the night? What can the Weiser Field Guide to Vampires do to help keep you alive? And we'll tell you about that next. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. We'll get to the Weiser Field Guide to Vampires coming up in just a second. Let me take one moment to digress to a guest in the past week who popped up in the news, and I say in the news, in an unlikely news source. Rick Collingwood, you might remember, was our conversation partner a couple of Sundays back when I was asking him about consciousness. We were having this conversation about how and where our conscious minds are seated, and how can we tell when we are awake? What's the difference between a waking state and a dream state? And this came out of the conversation about the final show of the of Lost. And so we were just kind of, you know, we were going through one thing or another. As a professional hypnotist, he was talking about both our waking states and our sleeping states and how they often blend and what we can do in either state and the things that we learn about ourselves in these various states of consciousness. I thought it was a great show. Really liked him. And so I was kind of shocked when I saw him on page two of the National Enquirer this week. Rick Collingwood is a guy who has been a personal hypnotic instructor for Mel Gibson. And the piece inside the National Enquirer was all about how he has trained Mel Gibson to become a licensed hypnotist. And it was only interesting in that here's this piece, and it was kind of a nice piece about Mel Gibson on the same week that this story comes out about this horrendous tape, which his attorneys are trying to suppress, of him berating his wife so badly and using such awful language, at least as it's been reported. And so we put in a call to Rick Collingwood to ask him whether or not he would be able to tell us, can hypnotism be used to make somebody be a better person? Can you use hypnotism to rid yourself of hatred, for example? And we tried for the better part of today to get a hold of him. We were unable to do so. Look forward to following up on that conversation with him in the future in regard to Mel Gibson, or for that matter, for anybody. And we'll let you know if we can get him back on the air coming up soon. Well, anyway, from Rick Collingwood to Colin Wood, the famed estate in the TV show Dark Shadows with Barnabas Collins, we turn to one of my favorite subjects, the subject of vampires. Both the legends, the practices, the encounters, old and new, are covered in the Weiser Field Guide to Vampires. And the author of the Weiser Field Guide to Vampires is a vampire himself. And so I say good evening to you, J.M. Dixon. Do you prefer Jeremy?
Either one is fine.
Okay. So thank you so much for taking our call on this very fascinating subject. I would say that having the author on of the Weiser Field Guide to Vampires is a little bit like having a fish on to talk about the Field Guide to Fish. It's unusual that the field guide itself is written by the subject and not just the observer.
Well, it's not just for people to observe the subject. It really is for the subject itself. The book really, for me, was always intended to be a helping hand for a lot of people to get, for, you know, anybody who's just recently discovered their own nature, to get a good start and a healthy idea of what it is to be what we are. And also for those who are, you know, already well experienced, to get hopefully a more in-depth and even scientific understanding of what we are, because I've tried very hard to explore the concept of vampires in a deeply scientific way, not just explaining it away, but trying to understand exactly what a real vampire is and is capable of.
Are great vampires born and not made?
Hard to say. I would like to think, as far as being a vampire is concerned, that you are what you are. You're born that way regardless. But as to what makes someone great, that is all manner of things. Sometimes it's just marrying the right woman.
Oh, that. Well, I certainly understand that. But in the case of a vampire, you were referring to people discovering their true nature. I heard you say true nature. So does that nature come as something that is as a result of one's birth? Or is it a nature versus nurture argument that one becomes a vampire by one's surroundings and encounters?
Well, according to my concept of what a real vampire is and my research into the subject, because it's not just my own personal beliefs. This is things that I have done my best to back up with, you know, firsthand accounts from other people that claim to be vampiric and, you know, science behind it that will actually understand it. But the concept of a vampire, real vampire, that is that it's a condition of the spirit. It is a different species of spirit than a normal human, with different needs and different capabilities.
What are those needs?
Well, the human body doesn't seem to be able to produce enough energy to feed the vampire spirit, and so that energy has to be taken in through other methods, whether that's psychic feeding or blood feeding or whatever else.
And as I understand it, you do both, psychic feeding and blood feeding?
Mind you, I'd like to preface this with the knowledge that drinking blood in many states in the U.S., as well as many countries in the world, is completely 100% illegal. So I don't in any way condone that practice, but I can admit that I have done that in the past. It's not something I practice today, because not that it's, in my opinion, wrong or immoral or anything like that, but just that if you allow yourself to feed only in one method, then you are ignoring your ability to take it in other ways. Someone who blood feeds regularly will begin to ignore their natural psychic abilities and ability to feel and manipulate energy.
You know, I will be asking at various times tonight questions from the Field Guide to Vampires, so I promise you we'll get to some of the source material that you write here for others. But if you don't mind me exploring that a little bit of what you just said there before we get there, is that I hear you say that you don't condone the practice of blood feeding. But it would it be unfair to say that regardless of whether or not a governing legislative body has deemed it legal or illegal, that there are vampires out there that feed themselves only through blood? They need to do it. And asking them to not do it would be like trying to legislate somebody's sexuality away.
That is true to a certain extent. I mean, if they really feel that that is the only method that they can feed, then that is their choice. But I would suggest that they should supplement that with psychic feeding, train themselves how to do it. I wouldn't, you know, try to dictate to anyone their personal preferences, but I don't think that they should ignore their natural psychic abilities. The reason that I am a solely psychic feeder today is because I realized that I was doing some unconscious damage to other people by ignoring my natural unconscious feeding process, because those people who do feed through blood, if they don't feed enough, they will take energy directly through psychic methods,
all right,
whether
well,
they realize it or not.
I'm going to need you to unpack that a little bit for the uninitiated like myself. So in the case of psychic vampirism, how is it that you draw energy from somebody else? What is the actual, what's the mechanism that delivers the energy from a person who has it to you, the person who needs it?
Well, it's very similar to drinking any liquid through a straw. Within the spirit, you transfer energy from one electromagnetic frequency to another so that it creates a vacuum in that particular wave. Energy is drawn in from the donor or subject or even victim, if you like the word.
What word do you use?
Generally speaking, I would prefer a donor, but that's not always optional. A donor is an individual that voluntarily helps the vampire feed, that allows themselves to be fed upon. But mostly, I think like most vampires, mostly I just feed off of large crowds whenever possible.
You feed off a large crowd as opposed to an individual. So if you're going to take energy against somebody's will or without their knowledge, you're doing it from a large crowd.
If I do it without their knowledge, it is simply because they're putting out that energy naturally and I'm just cleaning up after them. It's not okay. Something I'm taking directly from their spirit. It's just their exhaust, their excess.
Okay. How do you do that?
Well, as I was saying, there is the vacuum concept.
Right. I'm not sure I still understand that, because you talked about using a sort of a psychic straw. What is it? How do you take their energy from them? Let's say we're in a room together And I'm just, you know, I'm Mr. Energetic. I've had, you know, 9 Red Bulls as usual, so I've got energy to spare. How do you take that energy and use it for your own purposes?
Are you asking what process I go through?
Yeah.
Or exactly
yeah.
How the,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. What process do you go through?
That's
as a vampire.
Really, that's really more about sensitivity. It's hard to explain, but it's a, when a bodybuilder first gets into bodybuilding, they learn just a little bit at a time and they memorize the process and they do what feels right. It's very similar to psychic feeding. It's a very slow process. You do what works and you put away what doesn't. For me, it's, I have to find the energy first, kind of sense it with my mind and with my body. And when I find it, try to find an equilibrium with it, try to match myself to it so that I can draw it in. Some people use breathing techniques. Some people use mental techniques. It's really just about what works for the individual.
Would you say, okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Explain anything that's, you know, pure energy, because energy isn't really a physical thing. It's hard to pin down.
Well, I may be picking at that throughout the night and from various reasons, so we'll adjourn on the subject for the moment. But it does bring me back to a subject which a psychologist brought up on the air here a couple of years ago, and that is the avoidance of psychic vampires, that how important it is for anybody who wants to live a healthy life, an uncomplicated life, to identify the psychic vampires in their life and to practice proper boundaries between them, so that, you know, whether it's a dysfunctional relationship, whether there's somebody at the office, any time that psychic vampires are trying to take their energy from them, where every time they have an encounter with this person, they feel depleted while the other person feels energized. That, you know, we need to do everything that we can to avoid psychic vampires. Do you agree with that assessment?
No, I don't, but that's more of a language issue. I don't know why they chose to call that term a psychic vampire, because that's really a psychological vampire. There are a lot of people in this world who have psychological problems, who make themselves feel better by hurting other people. I mean, you know, we've all had that difficult boss to work with, or that, you know, person in a relationship that we just can't get along with. It never seems happy unless they're causing problems. But that's not a person who actually feeds on energy. That's a person with a psychological problem that enjoys hurting others.
Well, okay, so would you recommend that there be people out there that voluntarily engage in a relationship with a psychic vampire?
Oh, absolutely.
Why? What's to the victim's benefit to be in a relationship with a psychic vampire like yourself?
Anytime we take energy, it encourages the individual to replace that energy. They may feel weak for a short period of time, but as they replace that energy, it really increases their psychic and psychological and even physical metabolism for a long period of time. It can be extremely beneficial. And, of course, taking energy from specific areas can be beneficial in other ways. If a person has a headache, one of the easiest ways of alleviating that headache, before you even think about Tylenol, is just to have a psychic vampire drain the energy from the area. If you don't mind me saying so, when my wife is on her certain time of the month, she always gets me to help with her back pain.
Right. How?
So,
dare I ask?
Pain is a natural response in the nerve system. It is just energy being transferred through the brain, or through the nerves, to the neurons in the brain. All you really have to do is drain energy out of those nerves and the pain goes away.
All right, I tell you what, let's put that, just table that for the moment, okay? Because I want to come back to this, because it would imply, too, that vampires such as yourself are weak, and that vampires such as yourself are deficient, that being a that makes you a parasite that relies on a healthy host, or you don't exist. So we'll pick it up there. The Weiser Field Guide to Vampires, Legends, Practices, and Encounters Old and New with J.M. Dixon, an actual vampire, next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. The Weiser Field Guide to Vampires is out. Legends, Practices, and Encounters Old and New. J.M. Dixon is the author. He is a vampire. And just a moment ago, we had come to kind of a crossroads in the conversation where, and we'll find the answer coming up next, when one discovers one is a vampire, is one having to admit that they are special, as is sort of popularly related in culture and in media these days, that somehow vampire means that you are empowered in a way that's almost superhuman? Are you special in a good way, or is being a vampire a kind of sickness that deserves more of our sympathy? If they have to take the energy from others to survive, we'll explore that next with J.M. Dixon on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Talk a little bit about the history of vampirism coming up on Coast to Coast. But on this 4th of July weekend, we also see this, you know, huge movie opening for Eclipse, the third part of the Twilight series. I'm not a twihard, but I'll ask J.M. Dixon, are you? Have you been following the Twilight series?
Well, I have a 14-year-old daughter, so whether I like it or not, I've already seen all three movies.
I bet. Is she proud of her father, the vampire?
Oh, yes. My entire family is proud of me. Not just for what I am, but, you know, for the fact that I'm trying my best to get a writing career started and take it all very seriously, follow your dreams and all that.
Well, you're doing very good on that. It's the Weiser Field Guide to Vampires is very well written, so you should be very happy with that.
Thank you very much.
And when I say proud, I don't mean to say that that there's any reason why your daughter wouldn't be proud of her father, except if she's really into the Twilight series, what does it mean to a 14-year-old girl to say, yeah, my dad's a vampire?
Well, she knows the difference between reality and fiction. She absolutely loves the story of Twilight, but she also knows that there is a reality of vampires as well, and she doesn't ever get the two confused.
Does she tell her friends that her dad's a vampire?
I don't think she's told them that I am a vampire, but she's definitely told all her friends about my book.
Oh, well, that's interesting. How about your wife? Is she one of your primary sources of energy?
Sometimes, yes.
Okay.
Preferably not, because you don't want to, you know, have that constant drain in the house all the time. I mean, I would hate for her to go around all the time tired, but it's always best, and I actually do actually detail a little bit of that in the book itself about proper and ethical ways to feed. It is usually best to feed from outside the home. That way you're not bringing too much of that hunger home.
So where is it then that you go to feed or to snack, as it were, as a vampire, if you don't do it at home?
Restaurants are always good if you want to take from a crowd, movie theaters, anything like that. If you do have people that are close enough friends to you that, you know, you can trust them with your secrets, then you can probably find a donor that way.
The idea of having a donor, of requiring a donor, brings us back to that question at the bottom of the hour that I posed to you. Because, you know, if I'm donating blood, it's on the presumption that I'm healthy and somebody who's sick needs it. Mm-hmm. So the donor relationship would imply that you are in some way sick, that there's something that you need that somebody healthier has. Is that how you look at it?
Not really. In fact, this was actually one of the first things I wanted to really pin down when I started researching this book, whether it was a deficiency or just a greater need. And the best thing that I can liken it to is more to the concept that, if you don't mind me using the bodybuilder reference again, someone who uses a lot of energy, who is really building themselves bigger and stronger and you know, who has more power, simply needs to take in more. A bodybuilder will eat, you know, two or three times what the normal person requires.
Okay.
But if a vampire is more powerful, then it comes from natural evolution of the spirit and from taking the excess that they need from other people. No matter how healthy the human body that they live in is, it simply can't produce enough energy to feed the spirit.
Okay, but I'll take your bodybuilder analogy and I'll raise you here. I'll say, okay, the bodybuilder finds energy from food, but produces the effect of that. I mean, turns that food into energy and then builds on it through exercise, through a personal kind of discipline. That essentially, the bodybuilder is a multiplier. That the input is finite, but the result is not. That's all up to how much the bodybuilder is going to continue to put into the energy that they are consuming. So they take in calories and they turn around and they can make that into muscle mass when they do, but they don't have to expend it. That a lot of the bodybuilders, it's all about actually retaining one's extra energy. It's not a matter of having to clear out strength so that one can go back and bring in more strength. They want to retain every bit of that strength and then add even more to it. So when you talk about being a vampire, and again, we're talking with J.M. Dixon, the author of the Weiser Field Guide to Vampires. When you talk about being a psychic vampire and needing a donor, it seems more akin to the idea that that your body is a receptacle that has like a hole in the bottom that you can never be filled up. You never have enough energy to build on, that you can't replicate it yourself. You can only take it from somebody else. And that implies a kind of, like, that's sort of the break in the analogy for me.
Well, that might actually not be the best analogy for it, but I really did like your concept about the retaining of the energy or even the multiplying of it. I tend to think that vampires are spiritually ambitious, that we're always trying to improve ourselves and strengthen ourselves. Vampires do on average have very high IQs and do use their brains a lot. And even in the usage of the energy itself, it can be used to strengthen or enhance speed or any number of other things. The reason that we have to take it from others is simply because our physical bodies are not capable of producing enough. The spirit is bigger than what this body can currently feed. What is that bird? The cuckoo bird, I believe, lays its egg in the nest of another kind of bird. And as that bird grows, it eventually becomes much too large for the mother bird to feed.
But that makes you in a sense, as a vampire, it makes you more of a parasite. I mean, even to use the word, even to make the comparison to a cuckoo, and I think that that's a fair comparison in many ways, but a cuckoo requires other people to do their work for them, requires other birds, you know, to do that. That's they've learned parasitically to survive. And I'm not calling you a parasite. But I'm just trying to follow the models that you talk about being a vampire. And I'm trying to see, in the world of vampires, why I shouldn't want to avoid every vampire I run into? What do I get as a benefit to being in a relationship with a vampire?
Well, that depends on what you seek in life. As far as, you know, benefits from the relationship, it can be naturally, obviously, the same benefits from any other relationship. Is just, you know, companionship or intellectual conversation or anything like that. Vampires tend to be very ambitious people. So to be around a vampire is often to share in their ambition. And a lot of this ambition comes from the hunger itself, from our natural need to take in excess energy. As we hunger, we have greater ambition for everything else, and many people that are around us share in that as well. I don't want to call it, you know, following in coattails, but I certainly do find that people can be inspired by a more vampiric approach to life. If a person has everything that they need in life, then that is absolutely great for them. If they want to do more for themselves or be better than where they are now or to grow greater than who they are now, then they have to be around people that can help them do that. And vampires do tend to be very good at helping people do that.
Okay. Who are some considered to be some of the most successful, or as you use the term, ambitious vampires? Who in history have, would we put in the category of highly successful vampires?
Well, in my book, I make specific references to a group called the She in Ireland, who were supposed to be absolutely invincible warriors. There's also references not only to Vlad the Impaler, but to his master, Matthias Corvinus, King Matthias Corvinus, who was king of the entire area and who was, you know, the lord over the great and terrible vampire Dracula himself.
Okay, but to use let's use Dracula then as an example. If he's a model, and we say, okay, yes, he was ambitious, but he was also ruthless, and he was manipulative, and he drew his energy and his ambition came at the sacrifice of the lives of thousands. Why would we consider that to be successful?
Well, that depends on what side of the battlefield you're on. If you're on his side, then, well, you know, extreme situations call for extreme people. He used a lot of psychological warfare to fend off enemies that had been pounding at the gate for hundreds of years. He kept the Turks out of his small country for a very long time, all the way up until his death, really.
Well, he kept them out of his principality, but not necessarily out of his country. I mean, but was he considered a loved leader? Was he considered a leader that that the people wanted to see continue in power?
He is absolutely loved. There are people in Romania today that basically see him as a Jesus figure. They truly believe that he will come back to, you know, rule over the land again. They long for that day.
Are there other famous vampires in history of people who, in the, you know, pantheon of vampire lore, that you all know to be vampires, much like how, you know, some people who follow crypto history know who were the real Masons, that kind of a thing?
Well, you know, I wish it were that well developed. I mean, just now we are, you know, understanding the science of the vampire. It's hard to really say anything about the history of it because, you know, even today, you know, me in my daily life, I don't go around telling everybody I am what I am. I just live my life the same as everybody else. If there were people who were, you know, great leaders in the world or who were, you know, great generals or any number of other things, then they would really have no reason to tell everybody what they are. They would simply use their capabilities and help those that they could. I mean, you know, if I were to find a perfect example of somebody I think was vampiric, I would say someone who was amazing in battle, extremely ambitious in life, probably tall and known for being attractive. George Washington would have made a fine vampire.
I understand if one looks at those attributes in that positive sense, I could see where you would want to be doing that. But what if it's more like, you know, in the life of Dracula, that he was ruthless in battle and maybe even ultimately unsuccessful in battle, or lost the favor of his people in his time, like Dracula did. Would it be fair to say that there have been other presidents who were not, you know, tall or good looking, or other, you know, people in history that may have been vampires, that you all look as possibly as vampires, who are not known for being necessarily popular or for being, you know, great military leaders or people that were successful in battle?
Well, yes, there are certainly plenty of people like that. I can't tell you any specific examples right offhand. I didn't exactly, you know, do a lot of research into individuals like that. The thing that I like to stick to mostly is that it's been a very long time since vampires have tried to be, you know, warlords or presidents or things like that. Being happy and successful in life is certainly one of the best ambitions that someone can have.
You hit on the word warlord. That brings me back to why wouldn't we think there isn't some African warlord that's out there just, you know, enriching themselves or their small group of people by the slaughter of thousands, and they live, you know, they live on the margins of accepted society. They just do what they're going to do, and they, you know, they become, you know, celebrated in their lifetime for their ruthlessness. Why wouldn't we think of that kind of a warlord as being vampiric?
Well, maybe I'm just being idealistic, but I would hope that anyone with vampiric capabilities, intelligence, all of that sort of thing, anything that a vampire could have going for them, would seek better than that.
Okay.
I mean, I know that, you know, war is necessary in many ways, and the military is necessary in many ways, but ruthless slaughter is unnecessary, point blank. It is useless. A vampire is ambitious in the concept that they want everyone to be successful. Just themselves being successful really doesn't help anything. And more importantly, for, you know, truly modern psychic vampires, creating an air around them that creates negative, poor energy is going to make them very sick.
We're talking with J.M. Dixon, the Weiser Field Guide to Vampires. All right, so how old were you when you discovered you were a vampire?
I was very young when I realized what I needed. I didn't have a word for it until I was about 13.
What did you think you needed?
Well, when I was very young, I was rather sick most of the time. I was allergic to everything, including, you know, dust and cat dander. And, you know, I was a very sickly child. And I would even go so far as to say that it could have been called depressed. I began to realize this feeling that I could get when I focused with my mind, what I would now call energy, when I focused with my mind and was able to see and feel and manipulate energy, especially from crowds. And I began to realize that when I would take that into myself, I would be healthier. I would feel more at ease. I wouldn't be as lethargic as I was.
Who was your first victim, aka donor?
Hard to say. Even as, you know, even as young as 12 or 13, I was often referred to as that vampire, even though I didn't ever call myself that or anything. There were a couple of people, random individuals, really, just friends at the time, who I did take a small amount of blood from. The first time that I was a, you know, completely responsible donor, or not donor, pardon me, a responsible blood feeder in that regard, was when I was probably 17 or 18, and it was a friend.
Male or female?
Female. I never drink from men.
Okay. Why?
Just not comfortable with it, really. Never gotten along with men very well.
The Weiser Field Guide to Vampires, Legends, Practices, and Encounters, Old and New. We'll continue to explore this. When we return to the subject with author J.M. Dixon, I want to ask about that, about the idea of, to use the Carrie Prejean language, the opposite feeding with a vampire. And how does one pick out a victim/donor much in the way that I might pick out a steak. Pardon the use of the word steak. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett.